If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Joseph Arthur's Technicolor Dreamcast. Peter Arulian was born in the heart of the Rocky Mountains. As a kid, he could be found making up stories, writing songs, or involved in a pickup game of just about anything. In 2016, Peter was selected to write the novel to progressive metal band Dream Theater's concept album, The Astonishing. A year later, it was announced that he would be collaborating with number one New York Times bestselling author Brandon Sanderson on a new fiction series, a rock opera called The Bell Ringer. It's a game and more. He's also worked for a small press as editor for the New York Times bestselling writer. He also worked as a journalist, authoring a column on Voice for Progressive Magazine, for a progressive magazine in which he interviewed and profiled some of the great voices in modern music. He's a writer and more. He worked for Microsoft under Bill Gates as well. He's here with us now. Peter, welcome back to the show. How are you, my friend?
I'm well, thanks for having thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back on. So you're primarily a writer. Am I right about that? I mean, what are you working on now?
I divide my time pretty equally between music and fiction. The project you referenced in the setup, which was very flattering, not sure I can live up to that, so thank you, is a project I just finished book one. Brandon Sanderson's a big New York Times bestselling writer, and I just turned in the first book of that. And so I spend part of my day doing that. And then the rest of the day I spend in the interest of music, and that can be a mix of composition. Right now I'm working really hard with a new management team that has decided to represent me to try and push Symphony North, which is the group I put together to do the rock opera, The Bell Ringer, that you mentioned. So I try and keep those two things balanced. I'd be loath to choose one over the other, although if you put a gun to my head, I probably would have to decide music is the thing, to be honest with you.
So you've shifted mainly more to music then. What about music is capturing your heart and soul more than writing?
Well, it's the thing that's actually really happened for me is that I'm constantly searching for the intersection of those things. So anymore, I don't have a lot of interest in writing music that doesn't have some sort of narrative center. And that could be in the, you know, encapsulated and constrained to this, the song itself. But usually it's trying to deliver some sort of story motion across multiple songs, and usually in an album context. So I don't have a lot of interest just personally. I love listening to all kinds of music, but when I'm writing, I don't find myself moved as much by music that isn't trying to convey some sort of story. So in that way, I don't really relinquish a hold on either. I still write books. I'll always write short stories and novels. But there is something, I think, I don't know if you and I talked about this last time, but there's something ineffable about music that is, it just touches the soul. I know that sounds super, super sappy, but it moves people in a way that nothing else I know can. And I feel as sure about that as a listener as I do as a musician who's composing and performing. So, you know, if I had to choose, but like I say, all of my creative endeavors seem to be the coupling of those two things anymore.
What's the word ineffable mean? Something that you can't really explain?
Yeah, sort of indescribable.
Right.
You know, you know it because you feel it, but you can't define it.
Invariably, when something has an ineffable quality, when you try to describe it, you end up saying, I know that sounds sappy. That's always the result of something that's ineffable, right?
It's like a, you know, you giving a defense.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, and it's the hard thing with anything of the heart, you know,
exactly.
Try and describe love.
Well, what is love to you?
Well, I mean, I had this conversation with a Scientologist. It was interesting. I was coming from a writing conference, and we saw each other at the conference, and we had some conversations. We were at the airport just by happenstance, sitting across from each other at this terminal. And we started talking about this, and I asked her to describe love. Tell me what love is. How do you know what love is? And she said, well, it would be mutual concern for things, putting your interests above mine. I said, you can say all of those same things about a friend or any number of companions, and those are valuable and virtuous. But when you talk about loving somebody, it's something you know because you felt that, you've experienced that. It goes without saying. And so it's, it's a beautiful thing. And it's the same thing when you're talking about people of faith or belief. You know, there's tons of very ontological arguments for all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, there's something that is beyond words. And I think music inhabits that same space. And I know this is all sounding really high-minded now, but I think you don't have to have any of that conversation. It's the reason why I can go to a metal concert and I can be different in every other way from the person next to me. But we're there as brothers. You know, I went to a Queensryche concert a couple of nights ago, and the diversity of Queensryche fans is amazing. We were all there as Queensrycheans, you know? So anyway, it's a beautiful thing.
Talk about love. I mean, Queensrycheans are full. Well, you went to the same vocal coach as Jeff Tate, but Jeff Tate's no longer in Queensryche. Is that right?
Yeah, it's hard to know, you know, I guess separate truth from rumor. There were some ugly things if you believe all the reports. I'll be honest, a lot of the musicians I've met in my life who've been heroes of mine, I maybe wished I hadn't met them, because I learned things about them as people that aren't as, you know, flattering as I might have hoped. I haven't had that experience with Jeff, but that's certainly some of the rumors that have swirled. The reality, though, is he gets run down a lot for, he can't, you know, sing like he could when he was 20. And that's probably true of anybody who's been in the business for 30 years. But I saw him 18, 24 months ago, a club concert he was doing on the anniversary of the Mindcrime album. He sang start to finish every note in that thing and just nailed it. So, you know, you can take umbrage with him because of a lot of things, but it's not for want of his talent. But the new guy, Todd Latore, he's a gifted player. He's a drummer first, actually, gifted singer. And he gives it everything. Like he gave everything. In fact, I'll do this one shout out for Todd. Not that he'll ever hear this, but they did their set. And then of course they go and they do the thing where they wait for the encore. And he came out and sang three or four tunes. He ended with a song called Roads to Madness, which is an absolutely devastatingly athletic vocal tune to sing well. He crushed it at the end of a night of athletic singing. So I have nothing but respect for him having to follow up in Jeff's shoes.
You know, your interest in progressive metal and in, you know, long form narrative, musical sort of musical theater type stuff, it points to a kind of something that is often in conflict, which is the intellect and the heart sort of both taking prominence. Have you spent much time thinking about that? You know, you get like bands like the Rolling Stones, that's all just gut and heart and, you know, intellect. Yeah, it's smart. I mean, you know, they're you know, Beast of Burden is one of the best rock lyrics ever, in my opinion. But, you know, so there's intelligence there, but that sort of takes a back seat and is almost looked at with an eye of suspicion. But in the interest that you hold, those two things are sort of put on equal pedestals. If anything, the intellect maybe gets a little bit more of the front seat. What do you think?
Well, I would, it's a really, really insightful question. And the way that I would answer it is this: as a fiction writer, one of the things you do is you spend time studying the craft. You read books by good writing teachers, you go to conferences, you sit in on panels, you practice, you do all of that stuff. And you do it to sort of teach yourself and learn the craft of what you do. But in the moment of creation, when you sit at the keyboard to craft the story, that stuff is running in the background, kind of like utilities on your, you know, desktop. They're necessary for the operation of the PC, but they aren't running in the foreground. It's the same thing with great writing. The more you learn it, the rules of it, the craft of it, those things inform the writing without them needing to be sort of computed real time. And so the fiction gets better and better over time, and it's just channeled. So you spend time as a writer learning with that side of your brain that learns, but then you kind of get it into your fingers and into your process organically. You're not thinking critically about sentence structure and you know, all the voice and plot and all that stuff as you go. It's there present because you spent the time building it into your toolkit. And I think it's the same thing with players. You know, one of my great, you know, favorites is Dream Theater. Those guys went to Berklee School of Music and Juilliard and some of those places. And so they've done some of the formal training stuff, but man, when they sit to write and they're jamming, you wouldn't look at them and think, okay, well, they're thinking about Mixolydian and they're trying to figure out 13/8 real time. They're just playing because they have all these tools that they've spent time developing. And so they're ready. You know, I can do this arpeggio in a way that other people can't, or I can, you know, I've learned how to mix the modes, all that stuff. It's present in their toolkit. And so I think it's actually arrogant, interestingly arrogant, for players that don't spend the time to build the craft to deride these guys who have, because it's not that they are sitting and thinking about that consciously when they're beginning to write. It's just, it's another tool in their toolkit, and it's just present when they go into the moment of creation. And so I will stipulate, though, to the fact that there are many progressive musicians, particularly and most egregiously in the lyrics, who try so hard to sound smart that it feels very affected. And that's a failing mostly of lyric writing. But some of these players, you know, I've got tickets to go see Haken and Lacuna Coil, a bunch of really great bands who are doing some really interesting things because they've spent time like developing this broader set of musical tools. And they're just as good as they are. There's bands like the Stones, and you may love their music, but they can't do all those things because they just haven't the craft.
True. But they can do other things. I mean, there's an investor. I mean, with creativity, there's sort of choices, you know, and so it's what you spend your focus on. It isn't that the people that sort of make more intellectually based art are looked down upon. It's just it's like a choice, I suppose, of a sort of taste, I guess. You know, with David Bowie, he said that he was always writing musicals like Ziggy Stardust and the Spider, mm-hmm. Spiders from Mars. That sounds like a rock opera, and it was meant to be. He said a lot of his albums were concept albums that never made it to the stage. I also have made concept albums, and for me, that process was an evolution. I sort of evolved into that because it just became like boring, I guess, just to write song after song that were sort of disconnected. So I found it to be like, oh, I've evolved into storytelling, more of a long form thing. Has your interest been similar in this realm? Did you evolve into this? Did you used to write one-off songs and then it all of a sudden sort of spidered out into an evolution of writing long form?
I think even my earliest songwriting attempts were, even if they were encapsulated in a single tune, had a narrative center. That's because that's just been an interest of mine from the beginning. I was never very enamored of songs whose expressed purpose was getting laid, you know, or getting high or any of that stuff. And this is the beauty of music, of course. I don't want to alienate anybody. Like, music of all forms for all kinds of people, and I defend anybody's write to their own tastes and interests. But even my earliest efforts seem to want to tell a story. And it's because I have a kind of worldview that everything kind of breaks down to that. I mean, even the news, all they are is just little mini stories that we get told or we tell each other. And I think we learn best that way. We're able with stories, interestingly, to examine things we wouldn't examine politically, spiritually, emotionally, if we're just told those things. But if we kind of set aside our own sort of values or political predilections and we just will listen to a story, I mean, you could argue a lot of fantasy and science fiction literature deals with strong themes of racism and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of people, they don't see that on its face. They see these wonderful stories of conflict and tension and how people try and resolve those things. And it's one of the values of literature. And so if you ask Dream Theater, I don't think they'd say, well, we're trying really hard to be smart with our stuff. I think they're just, they're just writing the music the best way they see to do it. And for me, it's always been some sort of narrative desire. And it has grown, though. It has grown to one song can be too limiting to try and really explore a full story. And so I enjoy it's an artifact almost anymore. I mean, even artists I love are more and more just releasing singles, the art of the album, let alone the concept album, is not as present in the way sort of music is delivered today. And that makes me sad, but also makes me sound like a get off the lawn guy.
No, I mean, and I don't think Dream Theater's trying to sound smart. I think that's just a taste thing. My taste started in more progressive stuff and evolved into simpler rock and roll. So I get that as a total taste thing. Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. I guess stories are important because they evoke an emotional response. It puts you into the characters to where you can really feel the news, so to speak. It's funny you mentioned news is just stories too, because Andy Warhol told Iggy Pop, I heard in a recent interview, just like, why don't you just read out of a newspaper and that's a song?
Yeah. I like, as you were talking, I was thinking about Queensryche again, and there's a song at the end of the Empire album called Is Anybody Listening? And there's even a lyric in there. I've seen the news and there's not much more I can do. But the whole song is this it's a beautiful song that really is about connecting with another person. And there's some sort of very raw moments in that song, lyrics that say, I'll take what's real, bring up the lights. And so there's this, for me, it's just like this very soulful, enunciation of the artist and what is real and important and that I just loved. And I connected with that. Like, there's a story in that. And it's kind of like, it's kind of like if you've been in a band, you appreciate Spinal Tap more than the average viewer does, because some of that stuff strikes close to home. And that's the way with songs to me. Some songs will just, I can't imagine why other people don't love them as much as me. And then I realize, well, there's something contextual about it that's touching me. And so, I don't know, maybe I just haven't always been the guy who needed the party tune as much. And maybe someone else really doesn't want to have a deeper story or story at all. They just want Back in Black, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I just, I definitely, and this has been as I've grown older, I love those songs that just make me, that I connect with narratively. And so there you go.
Yeah. But I have to say this, Back in Black, that's a story we can all relate to. Been broke, and then you're back in black, baby. Come on,
yeah.
Peter. No, there's a story there for sure. You can get a story. Oh, go ahead. What are you gonna say?
No. I sounds like I'm grinding an axe, and I'm not, because
actually it doesn't.
Anybody to think there's not, just good time rock stuff that I love, because there is. I mean, I'll make this admission: like the first two, three rock bands. Brought me out of a decidedly new wave era of my life, where bands like Rat, Poison, Bon Jovi, and even though, you know, there's definitely some songs in there that have some little narrative kernels, a lot of that was just good time stuff. And so, and I still listen to that with a lot of nostalgia, but I guess maybe mostly what I'm describing is where I spend my own creative time.
Sorry to cut you off. I want to get into more where you're spending your creative time, but I got to go to a quick break. Stephen Percy from Rat. What a hero, man. What a hero. I love Rat too. We'll be right back with Peter Arulian right after these words on TNT.
You should hear what John Helmer and George Eliason are talking about.
The arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin. Now, this is the ICC that's doing this. And what happened is they've got a great headline. But here's the biggest problem with this. Neither Russia nor Ukraine are signatories to the Rome Statute that gives the ICC jurisdiction, and Russia does not recognize the ICC. We're talking about something very, very important here. We're talking about the health and welfare of children. On the basis of evidence collected and analyzed by my office pursuant to its independent investigations, the pretrial chamber has confirmed that there are reasonable grounds to believe that President Putin bear the criminal responsibility for the unlawful deportation and transfer of Ukrainian children from occupied areas of Ukraine to the Russian Federation, contrary to Article 82A and 82B of the Rome Statute. This is very important. It is a huge statement, and it is amazingly wrong on many, many counts.
War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Claims that renewables are cheap or will lower prices are proven false. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Joseph Arthur's Technicolor Dreamcast. I'm here with gifted writer and musician Peter Arulian. You were bringing up your worldview and how music related to that. What is your worldview and how does your music relate to it? And what do you think music's role is in the crazy times that we're in, and can it help to change things?
Well, I don't think that I would hate for it to sound as though my worldview is somehow should be adopted by people or anything, but I probably the best example I could give is the album I just wrote, called The Bell Ringer. And it's a holiday record. Tells the story of one of these guys that you see out in the cold at Christmas time ringing a bell. And that's a charity mechanic that is not owned, you know, by any one organization. And it predates any American use. It was originally from Liverpool, I believe. There was a mining accident and an entire town of men and young boys were killed in the mining accident. And there's all of these widows and young orphan girls. So some guy put up a steel pot on the dock and people coming off of the workships and off of the transport ships would throw their pennies or their change in, and they raise money for these people. So that's where it began. And I love that story because when I decided I wanted to write this record, I had remembered as a kid seeing these people standing in the freezing cold, ringing a bell to fetch a penny. And I just thought, who are these people that are willing to do that for so little? So that became the seminal idea. And when I wrote the record, it was deliberate not to be doctrinaire, to preach. There's no affiliation with any organization or anything like that. But getting to the worldview, the ideas of like helping the hands that hang down, which is another way of saying, you know, those who are less fortunate. There are some of those things that I think, if they're not universally held values, I think they should be. And so my worldview is, you know, at least where I spend my creative energy is trying to tell stories or write music that can thrill you for sure. Like, you know, in the record, I reimagined Vivaldi and Bach and Tchaikovsky and some of these other greats with just these amazing ripping tunes for people who just love pyrotechnics. But as much as the thrill, I want people to be edified. I want them to go out like, you know, feeling like they can make a difference. And that's sort of typified in the idea that even a single penny could matter. And so that's my worldview. I mean, I have other faith beliefs, but at the very heart or foundation, I think that sort of selflessness and kindness, which I argue in a lot of my conversations, what regardless of your perception or belief or investment personally in the holidays, there's always been, people are a little gentler, a little bit more patient with one another for whatever reason. This includes atheists and every person you can imagine. At least that's my experience. And I just don't know why, I hate sounding trite, but I just don't know why that's circumscribed only to those 6 weeks. So if any piece of music I write or story I write could touch people in that same way, that's, for me, that's a goal.
It's difficult to have that goal. And you brought up, you know, sounding trite, and I hope this isn't preachy or it's no way preachy, but when you have those ideals that you want to promote something like, you know, motivate people to give more, to be of service, to think of others, how much consideration goes into that in the creative process of like, I know I have this big idea I want to present. I know that I want it to be edifying, as you said, and motivating. But I also don't want it to be preachy. How do you police that? Because that's a really difficult tightrope to walk, really.
Yeah, that's a good question. For me, the only way to approach that is through story. So there's the kind of song where every Christmas there's more of these where they just sing about Christmas. So it's like levels of remove from the best ideas of Christmas, which are charity and giving, and giving, by the way, not just of time, but as you said, service, you know, giving your time, not what you have, but who you are. And that's the refrain in the last song of my record. It's called Gift of Self. But the way to do it is to not say, hey, go give money or even go give your time. It's to personify that. So and tell the story of someone who does that. So in my record, the central character, who is this guy who was a street kid, you know, was an orphan, ended up on the street, ended up being drafted into the war. He came home with trauma from the war. He married, had a kid immediately after his wife gets cancer and passes, and he has to make this like heart-wrenching decision that he is emotionally and financially not able to take care of this kid. And so he gives the kid into being adopted because he thinks it's the only way for the kid to have a better life. And at this point, he's so wounded by everything that's happened to him and all of these hard choices and things. He gets on a bus and he becomes an itinerant sort of worker town to town. And the story begins, he steps back off the bus into his hometown of the Bronx. And that's where the story commences. And so this guy meets these people, and this, many of the songs talk about these encounters, who are going through their own sort of tragedies. And some of them are tragedies of health. Some of them are tragedies of poverty, of homelessness, these kinds of things. And because he understands these, he turns out to be the exact right person to help them, whether it's just to listen, whether it's to offer some sort of assistance. And so instead of preaching about you should give or, you know, you should do anything, it just tells this story of someone who arguably has been put down and through so much tragedy in his life, but always finds a way to try and help. And I think by not preaching about it, but just showing somebody who has every, you know, you could argue has every right not to want to lend a hand at all. He's always been the guy on the sort of on the short shrift. I think that's the way. So
that's a really good answer. And that really illustrates it perfectly. One of the thoughts I have is like, you know, and it doesn't really kind of correlate with what you just said, but you give an opposing view or the sort of the opposing viewpoints, you give that voice as well. Like people who are concerned with giving think it's like socialism, which is there to take control. Or if you give to people who are needy, then you're sort of taking away their ability to pull themselves up. You know, if you sort of lend voice to that other sort of negative viewpoint, so to speak, that could be another approach as well.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the exchanges, there's a song on the record. It's kind of very written, very upbeat, but it's called No Fairy Tales. And it's this bell ringer. There's a woman that comes upon his pot, and she actually turns out to have a relationship with another person that he's met during the day. But she's sort of an activist, and she believes that these bell ringers are a social cancer, that they're selling fantasies, you know, because they're puppets of the whole Christmas you know, mechanism and machine. And so she has all of these very negative things to say about Christmas and people who ring a bell for charity. And she's this voice you're talking about. She's trying to sort of tear down in some ways, even some of the simple hopes that people have. And so it's interesting, because in my work to try and get the record out there and to find a team to help me take it somewhere, I did have a conversation with a guy at Disney. He was a one of the lead business development people there. And we had some conversations for a short time. And the song that comes after the one I just described is called Yes, Fairy Tales. And it's where the bell ringer gives a response to all this negativism. And he said it's the best song on the album. And it's interesting to hear him say that, because, you know, it kind of takes all of these arguments against selflessness and against the idea of hope embodied in something as simple as sort of Christmas celebration, and it attempts to answer that. It does so in the person of this bell ringer, who does nothing more than just step in to sort of take the harpoons from this young activist. So there is a viable way of doing exactly what you say by presenting the opposite view.
Oh, that sounds really well thought out. I mean, what was the response in this best song of the whole thing?
Well, that's what he thought was the best song. The first part of the song describes some of the, you know, the simple things of Christmas time. And so the bell ringer's kind of just calling to mind these beautiful stories that we tell each other about, you know, snowmen and a drummer boy who has nothing to give but the gift of his ability to play his drum, shepherd who leaves all of the 99 to go and save the one. You know, everybody wants to believe, I think a lot of people would love to believe that there's someone who cares so much about them that they would come into the wilderness for them, just for them. So he very simply kind of lays out all of these things that represent the hope of Christmas. And then the song transitions, and it's almost into a little bit of a fight song thing. There's a cool sort of snare drum thing. And then he basically says, I will stand here in the cold for the hope of, for the sake of every child who still needs hope. And he talks about, you can try and run me out. You can try and drag me down. You can do all of these things, and I'm still going to stand right here in the cold in defense of people who still need hope. And so it, you know, it's that response, and it's defiant. It's not militaristic. It's like, I won't be moved. Like there are people who need a guy like me, wretched as I might be, to stand in the gap. And that's what I will do.
Yeah, Little Drummer Boy, top number one Christmas song of all time. And I haven't heard all the Bell Ringer, so I have to, you might beat Little Drummer Boy, but that's why I love Little Drummer Boy, for that very reason. This all sounds very spiritual in nature, you know, the idea of going through hardship and bringing you to a place of ultimate real meaning in your life. This is a sort of narrative of God, for lack of a better way of expressing it. Is that something that's important to you? Do you have a strong spiritual belief?
Well, I'm a man of faith. If that's the question, I certainly do that. I'm not, I don't proselyte, and I'm not out to try and convince anybody to believe like me, because I go back to what I said before. I certainly hope that humans can agree on at least a handful of things, and things like kindness and helping those who need help in all kinds of ways should be fundamental. So I guess you could make the argument that, you know, because I'm a person of faith, maybe that involves itself in the things I do. But I took pains to not make the Bell Ringer doctrinaire. I really wanted the story to communicate these ideas, and that if you were moved, you were moved because you saw people helping people, and that, you know, that idea would get inside you a little bit, maybe soften you, or at least get you to think about the next time you pass someone who needs help. It could be a dollar. It could be donating time. We gave some of the proceeds from the tour and from the record to the Toys for Tots literacy program, because I love Toys for Tots, and it's the U.S. Marine Corps that established that and run it. But I also loved the idea that with this part of the program, that they're arming kids with literacy sort of tools to build their own futures. So, you know, I try and invect everything around this particular project with those values. But I would say that if you listen to the record, there wouldn't be a moment where you'd think, oh, well, he's preaching to me. I'm actually very proud of the fact there was one review we got from a Christian outlet, and my publicist at the time sent it to me. And I'm paraphrasing, but they effectively said it's a more successful Christian album than Christian albums, because it tells the story of living in a way that is giving versus trying to tell you to give. And so I was very proud of that, because we don't try and preach.
That's great. Peter Arulian is with us. You have such a great vocabulary, man. It's a pleasure listening to you talk, I have to say. Just your choice of words is fun. I want to find out a little bit about Bill Gates. We touched on it in the last interview at the end, and I want to hear a little bit more about that. But I also want to talk about this new management and the excitement around the rock opera, The Bell Ringer. We'll be right back with Peter Arulian right after these words on TNT.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
What happens to a person who tweets out that homosexuality is invading the church? Well, if you're a 37-year-old Christian theology lecturer, Dr. Aaron Edwards at the Methodist-run Cliff College in England, you get fired. According to the Christian Post, Edwards, who has worked there for 7 years, told the Telegraph he was also threatened with a counter-terrorism referral by the school. Here's what he tweeted. Homosexuality is invading the church. Evangelicals no longer see the severity of this because they're busy apologizing for their apparently barbaric homophobia, whether or not it's true. This is a gospel issue, he said. And for that, the father of five got the boot for what the school called misconduct, which had brought the institution into disrepute. He argued that maintaining an evangelical stance was crucial for the institution's student base and heritage. Dr. Edwards is currently considering legal action and appealing his termination with support from Christian Concern. He also set up a crowdfunder where he's asking people to contribute if they wish. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
If you're talking about it,
we have seized enough fentanyl to kill every man, woman, and child in the entire United States of America.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Joseph Arthur's Technicolor Dreamcast. I'm here with Peter Arulian. We were talking about his musical, The Bell Ringer. He also used to work for Bill Gates at Microsoft. I have Xbox Music Marketing Promotion in my notes, so I think that's what you did. I remember you said that that was a toxic environment and that it led you to becoming independent. I'm wondering what your whole take is on that, maybe if you can go into that a little bit, but also on what's been happening with ChatGPT and AI, and if you've used any of that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I have to say people's experiences at Microsoft certainly differ. I have friends that are still there, and they're still there. So for me, though, it was very toxic. They have, and there's a couple of, I think, things at the center of that. They have a review process, and most big companies do, even smaller companies. But the crux of it for the longest time was effectively just pitting everybody against each other. And this was something that Gates himself was fond of. He built a culture on something they called precision questioning, which really was just running someone down, looking for faults. And under Satya, who took responsibility for the company after Steve Ballmer left, they tried to change the culture, a different review process, where they weren't sort of, you know, looking for reasons to manage you out, as they say, but trying to change. They put up stickers on the whiteboards in the conference rooms about growth mindset and all of this stuff. But the problem was, is the culture was so deeply entrenched, it just didn't change. And so everybody was, there was so much backstabbing, even from people who are good people and away from the office that you'd have fun socializing with, that it was just nasty. It was just, you know, and most of the people, my colleagues that are there and have since left, all have the same experience of it. Problem of it, of course, is that the wages are such that, and the benefits used to be such that, they would call them the golden handcuffs. You know, you were loath to leave because where are you going to go you're going to do as well. So it was there were days, man, and I hate to admit it, but I would come out of meetings and I would get into the bathroom to just practically weep because it was so so derisive. And so I was fortunate to break away in time to try some other things with my life. Because for me, it was just not good. I've on the second part of your question,
Sorry, because I was actually rebuking myself for piling questions. I did that to give you an out if you didn't want to go Bill Gates, but you went there. So,
oh yeah,
I want to go to ChatGPT, but I want to follow up with this Bill Gates thing real quick first, yeah. Because it's interesting because there's, I guess, two modes of getting a lot out of people, right? You can encourage and do it with love, or this other thing you're talking about, which is just this sort of like pummeling, I guess. I mean, when you say that you would leave some of these sessions practically weeping, what would be happening? Would they just be sort of critically picking you apart? And where do you think that kind of philosophy comes from? That, like, because it just seems to me the way I would operate the best is through encouragement and love. I feel like with enthusiasm, everything comes from enthusiasm, from my way of thinking. But that's not the way a lot of corporations operate, or a lot of businesses operate. And there is something to be said, I guess, like a stern hand or whatever. But what was the nature of the questions that they would, you know, hit you with?
Well, I had one manager for about an 18-month stretch who I'd go into meetings where he's my backstop. He's the one I've built presentations with. And he would be the one to run me down in front of an entire room full of people. Like things about my presentation, things about my strategy or my plan or my ideas. And he clearly, if he had these thoughts about the work I was doing, they're the kind of things that we should have worked on together to improve in order to advance the company's interests. And this is what's so deleterious about the whole thing is you find people spending all of their energy trying to manage their career versus trying to help the company succeed. And so it's so wasteful. It's wasteful of company resources and it's wasteful of human resources. So, the general manager, that's exactly right. And the general
right,
manager,
because if you like level somebody's self-esteem, how are they then going to go and perform well? They would have to be basically a sovereign entity and to be able to take that kind of derision and then still go perform at a good level. Imagine like a basketball team and the coach says, "You guys suck," go out there and beat the team. It's like, huh?
I've heard it said anecdotally that a lot of people in positions of power in corporate America, in politics, they're borderline sociopathic because they're just not affected by that kind of stuff. And I certainly saw that as an operative quality in most of the leadership and through the rank and file in many respects. The general managers, I was going to say, they would have a commitment. You'd have to write these annual commitments, things you would say you would be striving to do, and you'd be measured against your success of the commitments. And the GMs at that level had a commitment to manage a certain percentage of their organization out of the company. And I think the institutional belief was if you always get rid of the bottom 10% and get in new people, you're always going to have the best. Right. But the reality is that the quality of people that they hire in, the hiring process is so rigorous. They had world-class talent that they were just crapping on and chewing up. The burn rate was about 5 years. Most people only made it 5 years because they just couldn't take it anymore. So, and that started with Bill. I'm not a terribly political person, but, he seems to be not different than he used to be in how he's, profiting off of all kinds of things in his subsequent Microsoft career and, endeavors. And it's kind of sickening to me. So while I have fond memories of a few of the people, I don't miss being at Xbox at all.
Right. Well, it led you to a life of independence. And, I tend to frame things in a spiritual way as well, that, God is leading us where we need to go. I think everything happens for a reason. And so I think it was ultimately a blessing. For some reason in life, we have to go through strange evolutions, and sometimes seemingly toxic ones to get to the purity of who we were put here to become. And speaking of purity, let's go to ChatGPT now. I'm just kidding. I don't know. There's nothing pure about it. But have you messed with it? It's an interesting tool for writers, isn't it?
Well, I started thinking quite a lot about AI when a former Xbox colleague of mine contacted me. He had early access to, I think it was the Midjourney AI art tools. And I started thinking a lot about it because as you mentioned in the setup, I did the record for Dream Theater. I wrote the novel, The Astonishing, and the conceit of that record is about a dystopian world post-apocalypse where all music is made by machines. And John Petrucci, who wrote the record and I collaborated with on the book, his idea was not that part of it was that the process of making music, whether you're a musician or you carry on with it in your life, the process of doing that has value in and of itself. And it's the same. It's the same argument, I think, with the tools that are coming out for story writing. You can do story writing prompts. They've even got it for music. They certainly have tons of them now for art. And I boiled it down this way. It's like, at the end of the day, what do we value as a society? Is it just the output? Like, you know, I've seen some great images come out of those, out of Midjourney and some of the others. I've read a few of the stories from the story tools. They're right now, they're awful. There's no intuition. There's, you know, there's no surprise. And I think it's because it's programmed. A lot of the delight that comes from storytelling is things that happen spontaneously in the creative process. And I don't know that they'll ever replicate that. But the larger point for me is, I think, and again, this sounds kind of high-minded, but I think with society, we should value the process of the generation of these things. I think that it's valuable for the person, and I think it's valuable for society for people to go through the process of it, learning how to write, learning how to compose. I've heard versions of symphonies that have been rendered by AI, and they're fine. And maybe there'll even be some brilliant ones, but it's kind of beside the point for me. And the problem of it is that the people that are driving AI forward kind of, they don't really care about this value chain in the production of the thing. They just care about how they can commoditize the result. And there's just enough of that in society that I don't know that that ship can be turned. It's the scariest thing for me. You know, it's not, of course, there's people going to get put out of jobs and all of that, but it's, you know, generations of kids who are never going to have to try an instrument, who are ever going to have to really try and write a story, do some of this critical thinking on their own. I don't think we can measure the deleterious effects downstream from this. And I'm not a social scientist or anything, but I've seen enough of the initial effects within, you know, around me. To think that it's we're moving way too fast in a technology that removes a fundamental sort of building block, you know, of us, and we can't measure the effect of that. So I'm a detractor of AI.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. It's well said, everything you said. I don't know. My view so far is I agree with you. The creativity that's coming out of them, there's just something definitely cold about it. And I think it could end up accentuating what makes human-made art great. And that will end up becoming more valuable, maybe, or more perceptible. But I guess that's an idealistic way of looking at it. I don't know. Go ahead.
I'll tell you the scary thing. An analogy from the writing world is it's become really, really easy to publish your own book. There's even like platform tools where you can just feed in your Word document and it does the formatting and all the stuff. And of course, now you can get a piece of art through AI, through Midjourney, that looks pretty darn professional. You can do all of that and you can stick it up on Amazon. You can sell it for a dime. You can do all this stuff to undercut people who are trying to use it as a way to feed their families. And what happens is there's this raft of mediocre art, mediocre storytelling. The gatekeepers, the people who used to be the ones who knew the difference, the editors and stuff, who would vet these things and even work with writers and the same thing in the other art disciplines to lift up artistic voices and to help them grow and mature, is gone. And so there's this raft of stuff. And what happens is you get this sort of consensus of good enough. Oh, well, that story is good enough. It cost me a dime. It was only a dime. I see people balk at spending $8 for an ebook, but they don't blink when they have to pay $8 a day for their coffee. And so this valuation of things, content that drives platforms, which is, you know, that's all things like Amazon is putting out with, you know, their subscription-based businesses, including their stuff that they're doing now with fiction. It's just that. And so my worry is it's good enough. If we get to a place where, you know, people who can write really great prompts for Midjourney and get some really good art, that becomes sufficient. You know, if kids, if young artists can't consider that they could feed a family this way or subsist, then there's no incentive to do it. You can say, well, maybe for the love of it, but I think that's dangerous.
Listen, Peter, I could talk to you for hours, man, and I hope to have you back on. You're really fun to talk to. I'm really feeling good about the Bell Ringer as well, and congratulations on the new management and all the excitement around that project. Please tell people how to find you. We've got like 30
just my name.
Left.
It's Arulian.com. Just my last name. And you can also look at symphonynorth.com. That's my music project.
All right. Peter Arulian, thank you again for coming on. Stick around, everybody. We got more coming up right after these words on TNT.